Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the Court. Again, my name is Christopher Laritz, and I represent CMH Homes in this appeal. This case involves another arbitration clause in a larger contract for the purchase of a manufactured home by the plaintiff, Mr. Eaton, from CMH Homes. CMH asks that this court reverse the order of the trial court denying CMH's motion to compel arbitration. This, again, was a larger transaction for a manufactured home, or a mobile home, as it's sometimes called. It was a good and substantial home, so the consideration was offered by CMH, and Mr. Eaton agreed to and did pay through a retail installment contract good and substantial consideration of, I think, $105,000. So there is good and substantial consideration by both sides in this case. Therefore, I don't believe that the issue of consideration or mutuality of consideration is at issue. Consideration has been given by both sides, and it's axiomatic that if good consideration is given by both parties for the contract as a whole, then we won't go back and look to see if there's separate consideration for each separate line of an agreement or a contract. Therefore, there is really no issue here of lack of consideration or mutuality of obligation. If we look at this arbitration clause in the overall contract, it is really quite clear and concise. It sets forth the rights and obligations of both parties, and there are no unduly burdensome clauses in it against Mr. Eaton. Both sides, both CMH and Mr. Eaton, knowingly waived their rights to a jury trial. So CMH is bound by that as well. CMH cannot come and file and ask for a jury trial. Mr. Eaton has veto power over the selection of any arbitrator that CMH may make. The arbitration clause does not make Mr. Eaton pay for CMH's arbitration costs or attorney's fees in arbitration. The clause does not require that Mr. Eaton travel to some far-flung forum to arbitrate this case. These are the types of things where the courts have found the clause contains some oppressive issues, some oppressive areas.
And you're addressing the unconscionability issue.
Pardon me?
You're addressing the unconscionability
now
issue.
Now I am addressing the unconscionability.
And so can you address the difference in who can go to a trial court for certain issues and who cannot, and whether they can make counterclaims?
Yes, Your Honor. In the agreement, CMH reserves the right to file in a court claims for three separate areas, and those are to enforce a security agreement regarding the manufactured home, to enforce a money obligation regarding the manufactured home, or to foreclose on the manufactured home. And it's true that CMH reserves the right to file a suit in court, not a jury trial, but a suit on those areas. However, it should be pointed out that CMH has done no such thing in this case, and that part of the clause is not at issue in the litigation and the arbitration, the dispute between the two parties.
What is the nature of the dispute here?
The petition alleges negligence, breach of contract, fraudulent inducement, and misrepresentation, and asks for money damages. If we look at the arbitration clause, those issues clearly come within the terms of the arbitration and are no way involved with any rights CMH may have reserved to itself to file those other claims in court. So this is an instance where that part of the clause reserving special rights to CMH is not even involved in this case.
Unless this court were to find that that clause was unconscionable and voided the contract or the arbitration clause, then I know you make a severability argument.
That's correct, Your Honor. There is a severability clause in the contract itself. And it's in the record, and I won't go through that because it's a typical severability contract. But I would also point out, and where Mr. Eaton points out that these three areas make the contract unconscionable, I think what the court has done, most all the appellate courts have severed out those parts of the contract that they find that should be unenforceable and enforce the rest. For example, in the Greenpoint case, there was a very similar situation where Greenpoint reserved the right to file litigation to enforce a security agreement I think they filed a replevin action. And the agreement disallowed the borrower from filing a counterclaim in court. They had to file their counterclaim in arbitration. And the court said the lender would not reasonably expect to be excluded from the court. And so we are going to strike that particular part of the claim or of the clause that disallowed the lender or the borrower to file a counterclaim in court. Otherwise, we're going to enforce the rest of the agreement. And there are several cases in Missouri where that has been done. In Swain, the case in the Missouri Court of Appeals for the Eastern District, where it was a forum issue, where the forum was required to be in Arkansas when the people were in Missouri, and the court said, that's an unfair forum. We're not going to make the plaintiff go all the way down to Arkansas. So they can have the arbitration here in Missouri, but we'll enforce the rest of the arbitration. There was in the Vincent case where it was the sale of a home, and the arbitration clause said that the home builder the head of the homeowners association could choose the arbitrator. He had sole right to choose the arbitrator, and that the buyer, the plaintiff, had to pay for the home builder's attorney's fees and costs regarding the arbitration. In that case, this court said, we're going to enforce the agreement, but we're not going to enforce those oppressive parts of the agreement. So if the court in this instance said, okay, we're not going to enforce that part of the arbitration agreement that allows CMH to file those three claims, then where would we be? We would be back in an arbitration on the claims that Mr. Eaton has filed asking for monetary relief.
What would happen if someone who had purchased a home thought that you were not complying with the security agreement or were overcharging and so inappropriately acting on the monetary obligation and so forth, would they have to go into arbitration and then you filed a counterclaim? How would that be in court? Would that be in arbitration?
Well, I think that would be, it sounds from the limited scenario, it sounds like a breach of contract. It would probably be put into a breach of contract if the homeowner is bringing suit against the seller or the lender, and I think that would go into arbitration. Then, if the facts were that the home buyer was failing to pay on their note, was failing to pay their monthly installment, then under this, I believe CMH could file a suit in court for enforcement of the security agreement. Mr. Eaton has been current on all his payments, so that's not an issue in this case.
Well, in this case, those provisions most likely come up in a reverse scenario. Is if you sought to file those claims, in their answer, if they thought those provisions were unconscionable, they could try to force you into arbitration as opposed to the methods that you reserve for collection.
Well, that hasn't been determined, but that might occur. There might be a conflict. What forum is everything going to be resolved in?
And that's what I was trying to ask about. How would that get resolved under this, or is that?
Well, I think what the court has said is that if in the Greenpoint case, that simply that you could allow Mr. Eaton or Mr. Eaton, whoever it would be, to then file a counterclaim in court if there is a security agreement. If there's security litigation going on, then the counterclaim could be filed in court. So that part of the agreement could be modified for judicial economy even, and to let the buyer file his counterclaim in court instead of arbitrating. But again, that is not even at issue in this case, and there's no indication that it ever would be. there are no further questions, thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. You have time on rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the Court.
Proceed.
Counsel. I think it's important to understand, to take a broader look at this arbitration provision in the context of the agreement. If you look at the arbitration provision, it starts out six separate times referring to the parties. And then it has this clause, which is why we're here, that says notwithstanding anything hereunto to the contrary. So is it hereunto in this arbitration clause, or are we incorporating the rest of the agreement? And I think that's an important point, because in the rest of the agreement, we're not just talking about here where CMH reserves the right to foreclose through judicial means, even though they could do it through arbitration. We're not talking about the fact that they could enforce their security agreement, which they could do through arbitration. What they also say is to enforce the monetary obligation against Mr. Eaton. And then the next sentence, they change that a little bit more, and they say to obtain a money judgment against Mr. Eaton. And then, so that, what kind of money judgment? Well, they, for the payments that Mr. Eaton has never missed, for some damage to their home that they claim in the brief that on delivery. But then you look back at the delinquency and default section of the agreement. And in that section, it says that CMH, when they enforce their money obligation against Mr. Eaton, is entitled to several things. Attorney's fees, not to exceed 15% of the value of the home. Court costs, cost of repossession. In addition, they can hold his personal property without liability until they get their money.
So are you saying then that the type of claims that, that your client has, because this contract is ambiguous, could fall under either arbitration type claims or claims that have to be claims that could be resolved in court?
I think his claims are claims that could be resolved in court, because I think the arbitration provision as a whole fails for both mutuality and unconscionable.
Because it's but besides the fact that it's an unconscionable arbitration clause, is the contract clear or unclear what type of these claims, what category they fall in?
I don't think it is. I think that it's so all over the place, and that's not a great legal description, but so broad. But broad makes it sound like it would encompass a lot of claims, but it's so nondescript that I think that these claims would fall in a circuit court claim. They're claims that he would make. In addition, there's the fraudulent inducement claim, which I talk about in a footnote. It really wasn't raised on appeal, so I know the court probably won't address it, but that is a contract formation question. And those are the types of questions that the court has looked at when they're analyzing arbitration provisions.
We look at the entire contract, not just the arbitration provisions.
Correct.
Separately.
Right. And I think that's important. You know, we talked in Baker, this court, on a small majority, 4-3, finds that there needs to be separate consideration for this arbitration clause. And I think that's the right result. You're talking about the waiver of a constitutional right by our state constitution, by the federal constitution.
So would we have to overrule Vincent v. Schneider to hold that?
I don't think so. I think Schneider, Vincent versus Schneider?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I think that this court actually in Schneider, and we call it Vincent on brief. So
okay, Vincent's
No, sorry. The court talks about mutuality. And it says it finds it unconscionable, the clause. But
it says it doesn't have to be mutual. You don't look just at the clause. I mean, it rejects the argument you just made that, and I wrote the dissent, so I'm familiar
right.
with that. But
and you did talk about how the parties didn't, in your dissent, Judge, how the parties didn't address the consideration issue.
Right.
And I think the parties have addressed the consideration issue.
Well, are you suggesting, though, that if there's valid consideration both sides, that every contract also has to look at consideration for every single term?
No, but I think for arbitration they do, and
what's your best case for that?
Fry, and is cited by Green, as cited by Baker.
I think what maybe Judge Fisher is getting to is the U.S. Supreme Court has said we have to treat arbitration clauses much like we treat other contract clauses, and you can't put up special roadblocks to enforcement of them. On the other hand, they can't be unconscionable. They're subject to all common law defenses and so forth, but you can't segregate them out for special defenses other ones don't have. How would this fit within that framework?
I think it fits right within that framework of that it's a contract law defense. The unconscionability, and we talked a lot about that, and I think the terms here are unconscionable. I think when you reserve the right, not only the right, but the option to decide where the forum for CMH's alleged wrongs against Mr. Eaton, they reserve the option. So not only do they have the power, they have the option.
Was Mr. Eaton required? I mean, could he have walked away? I mean, this is it's not a typical small consumer action where maybe they don't pay attention. This is a big deal. Did he have the option to walk away? Was he under duress? Why did he have to sign the contract?
Well, interestingly, in the answer, they admit that he signed the contract under duress. Now, they said it was inadvertent. And we didn't develop the factual record underneath procedurally. That issue is not.
Why couldn't he have walked away? I mean, why did he have to sign this contract?
At the time he bought it,
yes.
We alleged that he was induced to sign it for a number of tax incentive reasons. There's that first-time home buyer tax credit that was in effect at the time he purchased the home.
But that's not fraud.
He needed a home. Is it?
Mm-hmm. But couldn't he have gone somewhere else? Is this an industry-wide provision that he could never get could he not negotiate it? Could he not negotiate around it? Why did he have to sign this contract?
I think if you look at the contract, it's a non-negotiable contract. It's on page 3 of 4.
But why couldn't he go to someone else to buy his home?
I guess he could go to another manufacturer home seller.
Is there a record here as to whether or not this is a common term in all manufactured home contracts, or is that not in the record?
There is not a record on that issue. I guess we could consider the other cases where it's been used in a manufactured home sale. So I think it's probably an industry-wide provision, and it's in most contracts, sales contracts of this nature, and installment contracts.
And there are overlapping arguments being made here about mutuality of obligation and a separate argument about unconscionability. And one aspect of unconscionability alleged is lack of mutuality, but there's other aspects also. Schneider, or Vincent, said that mutuality of obligation is a dead letter in contract law, that you look at the whole document. If this court were to continue to apply that rule, or to find it applied here, it's a different factual case. Is that still a relevant factor for unconscionability? Can you summarize all the reasons why you think it's unconscionable?
Well, I think mutuality is a factor in unconscionability, and in Schneider or Vincent, the court says that mutuality in isolation is alone insufficient to make it unconscionable. So it's not ignoring the fact that mutuality is a factor in unconscionability. I think it's an important factor.
It's not an essential factor to the contract, but it's one factor the court would look at in unconscionability.
I think that's right.
And what are the other factors that are present here?
Well, the fact that even if CMH were to seek judicial relief for their losses, that were prevented from filing a counterclaim, Brewer sets out a number of factors. And I was asked at the Court of Appeals, isn't this provision in this contract a little less offensive than the one in Brewer? And at the time I was, you know, I thought it might be a little less offensive. And then when I went back and looked and worked on my substitute brief here, I looked at what Brewer sets out, and Brewer sets out, well, it's unconscionable because you have it forces attorney's fees onto the purchaser. That does in this contract. It sets out that it forces costs on the purchaser. CMH's agreement does in this case.
Does it say that all attorney's fees and costs are? Yeah. Are okay.
I can, of course, it won't be right where I need it, but it says all attorney's fees and costs.
If you lose.
If you lose. Up to 15% of the value of the home. So that's not an insignificant number for someone.
And have you cited as cases that say you can't do that and put an undue amount of attorney's fees and costs, that burden on the person suing, because it, in effect, denies them a forum since it's too expensive to litigate?
I have not cited the cases on that. You know, I think Brewer talks about it a little bit in the sense of it looks at it in the class action sense that, you know, that it'd be hard to find an attorney to represent someone, and that forecloses their ability to seek a remedy. But when we start listing out the factors,
but in Concepcion, the Supreme Court said that's not really. You have to look at the idea that it's hard to find an attorney. You have to look at the inception of the contract of the arbitration for the unconscionability issues, and then it came back on Brewer 2, and that Brewer 2 was not taken by the Supreme Court.
Correct. And in Brewer 2, Judge, you talk about how that this unfair surprise and oppression can come at the time of contract formation, right, or at the time when the circumstances bring them to light. And that's what's happened here.
Why is severance insufficient?
Severance is insufficient because this is an essential part of Mr. Eaton's rights and the nature of this contract. So severance in the other situations, in the other cases, you're talking about things such as the forum, where it was unconscionable for a purchaser to travel to Arkansas for his arbitration. It's unconscionable for the director of the home development, who just happened to be related by business to the defendant, how that person, that's unconscionable that he would be the arbitrator. If you sever, let's say, the counterclaim, you're still allowing one side to dictate the option and the reservation of power to make a decision, which makes it a unilateral, an illusory agreement to arbitrate, because they now still control that decision. Then, I guess, if you start severing off portions, when do you stop? So at some point we look, and the courts have talked about, and on unconscionability, you look at the reasonable expectations at the time. It's not reasonable for a purchaser to expect to, 6 years, almost 6 years later, determined by an appellate court what the rights under his contract are. If we start rewriting contracts and reforming contracts, that's a more difficult rule to manage judicially and as counsel and as purchasers, rather than an arbitration clause with a self-help provision reserving power of self-help to one party, the party that happens to be the drafter of the clause, fails, and then it's not a mutual obligation, and it fails because it's unconscionable. If there's no more questions, I ask the court to affirm the decision of the trial court and allow this matter to proceed.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
If I may briefly, Your Honors, I want to make clear that the arbitration agreement and I don't think Mr. Sudercombe was trying to say this, but the arbitration agreement does not place the cost burden on Mr. Eaton for the arbitration.
What does it say?
It says nothing about that. The arbitration clause says nothing about who will bear the cost of arbitration. So presumably, each side will bear its own cost. Mr. Sudercombe was citing from another part of the contract, not part of the arbitration clause.
Well, I mean, this court has said even each side preparing, bearing its own costs is inappropriate in that there's consumer statutes that give the prevailing party the right to recover their attorney's fees. That's in Vincent.
Yes, but they didn't agree to do so in this case. In this case, the arbitration agreement made no mention of that, and
you're saying it would be governed by Missouri statute and the Missouri Arbitration Act as to how the costs are apportioned, because it's not.
Well, yes, the
addressed.
Statute would, of course, the statute would govern, Your Honor. But what I'm pointing out is, CMH did not put any particular burden on Mr. Eaton.
Is there some other provision of the contract that does so?
When it talks about if CMH would file a claim for Replevin for the enforcement of a security agreement, in that instance, that's what Mr. Sudercombe is referring to, not the arbitration agreement itself.
So anything filed in court,
correct.
The cost of enforcement.
Correct. And I would point out that what Mr. Eaton's position is that if you have a contract and then you find one part of that contract that could be problematic, then use that to negate the entire contract. As has been pointed out, you can't just slice out various clauses that we like and look for separate consideration for each clause. We have to look at the contract as a whole. Clearly, there's adequate consideration, substantial consideration given by both parties. The facts weren't briefed on this, but it is in the facts that in the purchase of a manufactured home, the buyer goes in, they negotiate price, they negotiate the model of home, how many bedrooms, carpet, cabinet,
but
all
they don't negotiate whether to include an arbitration clause or not. That's a standard clause, though.
That is in the contract. Provision. That's true. That's a standard clause in the contract. Yeah.
But can it be negotiated?
I think Your Honor, there's, from my experience, anything can be negotiated in a mobile home sale. And so,
has anyone negotiated the arbitration?
Not to my knowledge. Although I can say that I've arbitrated clauses and been in court on cases. So
let's say the plaintiff has a complaint and it starts with arbitration. CMH can then say, "Well, okay, I want to collect our money. You've stopped paying because the car, the mobile home is leaking or it's whatever it's doing." It shouldn't be doing, but when we're still going to sue you, and you can't counterclaim, or you can't bring any of these claims in the suit in court. Can you short circuit the arbitration by basically going to court?
Well, that's what the clause says, and I think what the parties agreed through substantial consideration to that. Now, again, I think in this case,
the guy is current on his payments.
He's current. This is not even at issue. I mean, what we're talking about here, what Mr. Eaton is talking about, it's not at issue. It is not involved. CMH has filed no claim, and his claims clearly come within the arbitration clause, which are very clear. All disputes, claims, or controversies arising from or relating to this contract or the subject hereof. Clearly, his claims fall within the arbitration contract. CMH has not filed any claims.
All claims except for
those three. Yes, sir.
And I thought in your first argument you had conceded that if you had initiated a court action and his claims were operative either as defenses or counterclaims to that claim, then he would be allowed to file those in your court action.
I think what I conceded, Your Honor, was that if the court found that that was an offensive clause, then the court's remedy would be to allow Mr. Eaton to file the counterclaims in court.
Any further questions? Thank you. The matter will be taken under submission.